Up next, we're going to be talking about one of the most troubling aspects of this recession, which is the long-term unemployed. The number of people who are unemployed in this country is massive, but some 6 million of them have been unemployed for more than 6 months, and their prospects are getting grimmer and grimmer. A couple days ago, I recorded an interview with Andrew Stettner of the National Employment Law Project to explore in depth that issue. I'm Esther Kaplan, and this is Beyond the Pale. I'm joined today by Andrew Stettner. He's Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, which is dedicated to promoting policies that create good jobs, strengthen upward mobility, enforce worker rights, and help unemployed workers regain their economic footing. He's been a guest on Beyond the Pale before, and we're very glad to have him back. Welcome, Andrew.
Good morning.
So, nearly 500,000 people have been filing for unemployment each week this summer, and some 15 million more are already on unemployment, which still hovers nationally above 9%. Typically, unemployment benefits cap out at 26 weeks. Currently, they've been extended to up to 99 weeks in states with the highest unemployment numbers. The latest extension was just passed by Congress with great political difficulty at the end of July, with tremendous advocacy on the part of your organization. But even that may not be enough. Currently, there are 5 or 6 jobless workers for every job opening. You've said quite logically that we need to extend unemployment benefits until jobs come back. But when is that? With the effects of the stimulus fading and census jobs ending, Friday's jobs numbers were frankly extremely discouraging. They show that payrolls shrank in August and unemployment again ticked upward.
You know, you're identifying a crucial problem that we have. We've never seen an economy like this in the United States, where we've had a sharp decrease in demand and a huge increase in unemployment and such a tepid recovery. In the past, when we've had such severe downturns like the 80s, it was kind of like a roller coaster. Things would bounce up and bounce down. So you may get laid off, hired again, and laid off. And that's not happening as much as it once did. Now what's happening, people are getting laid off, and they're taking months, if not years, to find work again. So it's a real fundamental structural problem that we're facing. The unemployment benefits is just the first Band-Aid. You know, if we don't keep a more robust program of unemployment benefits around, people are going to fall into despair. But it's a much deeper problem that we have to have. The only way we're going to solve it is really to get jobs to come back.
So a new analysis from the National Employment Law Project, Where the Jobs Are, documents what many of us, I think, have already suspected, which is that to the extent that we've had job growth this year, it's in poorly paying jobs, $15 an hour or less, according to the report. In vast numbers, people who finally find work, what we might call the lucky ones, are finding jobs in the service economy or other low-wage sectors that pay dramatically less than what they used to earn. Walk us through your findings.
A lot of the job losses were, you know, they're very across the board, but we had big job losses in good quality jobs, you know, whether they were finance or blue-collar jobs or construction that paid a good wage. And what we're seeing in growth is more at the lower end of the spectrum. So people obviously they don't even want those jobs if they were, you know, earning a living wage. And those employers don't always hire them. You know, the employers will say, well, I don't want to hire this person for a $15 an hour job if they had a $40 an hour job before, because I think they're only going to be here a month until they find that better job. So even people, many people are willing to take those jobs, but they might not even get them. What we've really seen so far, you know, is alarming that it may be a trend that continues to hollow out the middle of the economy, you know, that it becomes increasingly polarized between the very wealthy and those who are, you know, frontline workers. And that middle, you know, these key $20 an hour jobs, you know, a job that if you work full time, you can earn $40,000 and live with yourself and your family with dignity. You know, that is really, disappearing in the economy. And, you know, that has huge implications for prosperity. And what we're seeing, you know, now is, you know, because I think we're not putting the left spin on that, the right spin is coming on it. It's something wrong with government is why this is happening to me, rather than what is the role of government to improve the quality of jobs, what is the role of unions to improve the quality of those jobs. People are very angry about this trend, but they're blaming the wrong people.
the rise of the Tea Party. There's evidence also, according to a Columbia University economist who was quoted in the New York Times last week, that the income loss for people who take huge recession-related pay cuts, these people going from $40 an hour to $15 an hour that you were describing, that this is lasting, that it takes a tremendous amount of time for once middle-income people to bounce back to their former earning power. Is that reflected in research coming out of your organization as well?
Yeah, I think that's a long-term trend, is that, you know, you see people that lost these good jobs. You know, I think of Lou Uchitel's book, you know, where people lost good jobs doing aircraft mechanic work, and even the ones eventually who got some kind of job later in a non-union facility in the South, you know, they may be okay, but they just never get back to where they were at. And I think that's generally the experience. You know, as government data that Glenn Professor was talking about has been tracked, you know, you've seen this. Most workers who get reemployed do have to take a pay cut and are willing to take a pay cut because they need to work, but often never get back to that same point. You know, so we're seeing a huge downward mobility in the economy. We've had, you know, we have, as I said, 15 million people that are unemployed. 6 million of them are long-term unemployed. Most of them will not get back to where they were at before. So that's what we call this, what you think about is the scarring of this recession that won't easily come back, you know, unless, you know, we can build from the ashes of this a resurgent idea of worker rights and worker justice. I'm still waiting for it to happen, but the potential seems to be there. If corporate profits keep rising the way they are and the profits aren't shared with working people, you know, I think eventually people will say, well, there's something wrong with this picture. Why am I not getting the share of this in my paycheck?
We're speaking with Andy Stettner. He's the deputy director of the National Employment Law Project, an advocacy and research organization. What about the unlucky ones, the people who've been unable to find work at all despite applying to dozens or even hundreds of jobs? It starts to feel like entire sectors of the workforce have simply disappeared, and you alluded to some of them, I guess. The housing bubble created a lot of construction jobs that don't seem to be coming back. Decent manufacturing jobs also seem not to be coming back. Is there a sense that some of these jobs could eventually return?
Well, I think in terms of the workers, when you see, and there were some bright spots in Friday's unemployment report with private sector payrolls growing a little bit, you do see people come out of the workforce and come back into the labor force. So people are ready and willing to work. Many of them who have dropped out will come back to work if the jobs, you know, are there. So will jobs come back? I guess that's the $6 million question. There are fundamental things that are strong in our economy. Workers are productive. You know, there's a lot of innovation. You know, there is some underlying strength, you know, in the economy. Often we cut it off. I mean, actually, manufacturing is doing very well right now. And in fact, if we had done more to protect our manufacturing sector, you know, during the 90s and early parts of this decade, now with lots of demand overseas in developing economies for, like, you know, big equipment, electronic equipment, we'd be doing maybe as well as Germany is doing. You know, incidentally, Germany has a €300 a month lifetime unemployment benefit for anybody who needs it. For example, doesn't have a spouse, is working, is just a single individual, and their unemployment rate is around 7.5%. So the idea that unemployment benefits are causing the unemployment rate, you know, to be high is pretty ludicrous.
You're talking about the right-wing assertions that somehow extending unemployment benefits is encouraging sloth or something like that.
A prominent opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal by Robert Barrow, it's getting recycled on Fox News, saying the unemployment rate would be just 6.8% if we cut off the extensions of unemployment benefits, and magically 5-6 million people would find work. You know, but the real, you know, the real damage that you fear, and, you know, we've secured a 99-week of extension of unemployment benefits through November 30th. It's the longest extension of benefits we've ever had in this country, and it's been through great advocacy champions in Congress and advocacy by unions and community groups along with us. But people are running even out of that. And if those of us that work with the homeless, you know, we'll talk, well, how did this happen to you? One thing you hear over and over again, the bottom fell out when my unemployment benefits ran out. And so for many, for those people who don't have strong family support, some the bottom may fall out so deeply that they won't be able to get back in, that they won't have the structures around them to look for jobs, to go back to work. And so there will be people that will become not only the new poor, but the permanent poor, and they won't be able to get back on, get back onto their feet. And so that's kind of a huge concern that we have, and it's why it's so important, you know, that we have subsidized job programs, aggressive outreach with food stamps and other types of support, housing support, so people, even if they're not on unemployment benefits, need to be able to, you know, sustain themselves.
I mean, let's drill in a little bit more into the numbers on this. I don't know whether people realize that in past recessions, the long-term unemployed have typically maxed out at about a quarter of the total unemployed, and now we're up at around half. So we're talking about 6 million or more people who are dependent on those extended benefits. Your organization has done incredible work on that. It's kind of impossible to even imagine what shape the economy would be in right now if those millions of people had already been cut off. But in your research and talking with unemployed people, what is their experience right now? Even those who are still receiving the benefits and haven't teetered over the edge, as you were just describing.
Well, I mean, I think how we got there is just, you know, companies just kind of slashed their payroll, anticipating, you know, that the economy would be at its worst, and have managed to figure out how to even deal with the slight kind of recovery we have without increasing their payrolls. You know, I think people are trying to stay optimistic. You know, we've had record numbers of people go back to school, trying to retool and retrain. But then there's just this deep-seated frustration that people have, and it's can be very faceless and humanless. Applying for a job today is going on a website where you submit your resume online, and you don't even get an acknowledgement. And so people don't even know if they're even competing. And so they're just, you know, they're feeling that they're staring into the abyss. And, you know, they do their networking. They talk to everyone they can talk to, and they still don't surface, you know, something. It's a deep sense of frustration. And then you have people contact us. You have people say these people are lazy, they don't want to work, you know, that we should cut them off. And so that it's the feeling of otherization. At least those who have, you know, are on unemployment benefits or have benefited from one of these extensions, they feel like somebody is listening to them. The greater public does care about them. If we decide to cut off this support, then it just kind of pushes people over the edge. You know, what's about one thing we've really been advocating for? You know, like in the Great Depression, if the private sector isn't creating jobs, the public sector should come in and be an employer of last resort. And I think because we have not done a good job of projecting the argument out, unemployed people don't even understand what you're saying. You know, you say, well, let's fight for a public job. They think you want them to be a firefighter or something. It's not resonating. So we're trying to talk more about the assets of the Recovery Act that have created several hundred thousand temporary positions, and try to fight to keep those and expand those and get unemployed workers to mobilize for them. Because I think we think it's very important for unemployed workers now to mobilize for jobs and demand employment, which is what they really want.
Well, there are a couple of proposals on the table. One that the National Employment Law Project is forwarding is the extension of these this TANF emergency fund, the Temporary Aid for Needy Families Emergency Fund, which was folded into the stimulus, and it subsidized the creation of a quarter of a million public sector jobs. That's going to time out later this month, and you're calling for a renewal. I know Representative George Miller, who chairs the Labor Committee in the House, has proposed a $75 billion initiative over 2 years for cities and counties to develop new jobs. What are the prospects for proposals like this?
Well, we think that the emergency TANF fund, you know, is one that if we make enough stink, you know, can be continued and expanded on. We think that's kind of crucial to help build momentum for a larger job creation program, especially if the economy, you know, is still weakened. When you poll workers right now, it's just really odd. Like, they're 70% against stimulus, but they're 60% for job creation. So, I mean, I think we're trying to talk, you know, in those veins. And also, you know, smart programs that subsidize private employers. If private employers are willing to create, you know, decent-paying jobs and keep people on, you know, for a certain period of time, there are good models in depressed areas, you know, more local models that were tried, you know, in depressed areas to help subsidize employment, which can have a certain kind of momentum. And those programs do seem to have some affinity, you know, in Congress and even some bipartisan support. So hopefully we'll have more programs like that that can, you know, encourage hiring. But it's still, you know, it's this whole, you know, the barrier is this whole deficit piece and a great resistance. So what the real fear is that people will just kind of throw up their hands and just kind of hope that the economy will get better, which would really be just the rest of the world pulling us up. It wouldn't be anything that we're really doing actively right now. It's a very hard political moment, and it will really take more organizing and activism by unemployed workers and their allies to open up more space.
We're speaking with Andrew Stettner, Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. It's frightening to imagine, come January, a Congress newly injected with Tea Party candidates who are bent on tearing down federal spending at any cost, just at the time when we need a renewed stimulus and need new investment in jobs. I think that polling that you mentioned is fascinating, that people actually want job creation initiatives but are against federal stimulus spending. How is it going to be possible to build political momentum in that kind of climate come January?
Well, the hardest thing, you know, is that we've always had some form of extended unemployment benefits in the post-war period whenever the unemployment rate was above, you know, 7%. And in June, Congress actually let the extensions expire. And in fact, you know, consumer demand from unemployment benefits dropped by 10%, contributing to a real lagging in income in the country. And, you know, we face another expiration of the entire program in November 30th. And it's going to be our hardest fight yet to continue, and there's every justification to continue extending unemployment benefits, given that we're just not, you know, we're not even having enough private job creation to accommodate the natural growth of the workforce as people graduate college and, you know, become 19 years old and need to find a job. You know, that's about 150,000 a month, and we only have 70,000 private sector jobs being created. So just even the basics is going to be this huge fight. You know, I think the best, how does political will happen? You know, if they have to govern, you know, it's a different thing. You know, if you're in charge and you're the one that really cuts off unemployment benefits and just doesn't delay it, it's a little different scenario, especially if you're from a state that is, you know, essentially more politically divided. So, and we're going to need the president to take a different approach. You know, he did his great press conference when the extensions were cut off with several unemployed workers, and he was very empathetic and passionate, and we just need him to do that more often and to stand up for the programs. There's a report that we worked on with USA Today that one in six Americans is relying on one of the big anti-poverty programs, unemployment, food stamps, or welfare. It was kind of pitched in the reaction to this is how government has gotten too big. Well, we need the president to be out there and said, this is what's holding up our families and holding up our country are these programs, and we're going to defend them against cutbacks. And, you know, a lot of these are voters, and he just needs to say that. And one of the greatest things I read is that voters can hold more than one thing in their mind. They could be mad about their deficit, but they still want their brother to get their unemployment benefits. So you can't just be so craven on this deficit position that you're not for anything that voters do support and do identify with. And I'm afraid that that's where the Democrats are headed, and, you know, where progressives are headed. We need people, you know, really in both parties to say strongly, you know, that they're for unemployed workers. And we have a history of bipartisan support on some of these items, so we have to see if we can seize it again.
Speaking with Andrew Stettner, Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the way this recession is playing out that is exacerbating what was already a really horrible wealth divide in this country. In August, the New York Times' David Leonard wrote a disturbing piece in the business section, noting that this recession has actually been good for people who've managed to stay in their jobs, partly because inflation is so low. Real wages have risen by about 5%. So while those without work get more and more desperate or accept drastic pay cuts in order to re-enter the workforce, those who've remained employed are generally doing better. And then you add to that the data from earlier this year showing that unemployment itself is concentrated among lower wage earners, with those earning above $150,000 facing only a mild 3% unemployment rate, and those earning below $13,000 facing as high as 30% unemployment, which is just an astonishing number. what's driving this, and where do you fear this recession will leave us in terms of a nation divided by class?
In terms of what's driving it, first, just the first reaction is, wages nominally have not gone up. So as soon as, if we do have economic growth in the way we've had it in the early 2000s, and you start seeing, for example, big thing rents, you start seeing rent of apartments go up, well, all of a sudden this supposed trend, washes away because the actual paychecks are not going up. It's just that inflation has been so super low in terms of the economy. Basically, it's a consequence of, the financialization and leave it alone view of how we need to manage our economy. Left to its own devices, an advanced economy in today's world is going to go this way. You have the majority of production and consumers can be done cheaper in developing countries. So there's obviously financial profits to be made doing that work. And some people get very rich in developed countries that have engineering know-how and capital. But labor, by definition, is going to get weakened in industrialized economies if we just leave everything alone. So unless you have public policies that say, we're going to share this prosperity, we're going to make sure that we're not going to let our economy go the low road, whether that means by having kind of standards around work, living wage policies for how we spend our government money and how private employers have to treat workers, and whether we have industrial policies that protect and foster sectors of the economy that can pay decent wages, like manufacturing, then we're going to go this low road. So that's really the only solution, is to kind of lift up and lift up the floor and have economic policies that support the middle.
This gap that we were just talking about is actually far worse for African Americans. While African Americans make up about 11.5% of the workforce, they make up 22% of the long-term unemployed. What are the implications of that? I mean, I've read in some places that even during the Depression, the racial unemployment gap wasn't as extreme as what we're seeing right now.
Although there's a lot of same old scenarios to this where African Americans are the last hired and first fired, I think there are some new dimensions as well. There were gains in wealth and savings that started to happen a little bit, definitely in the 90s and even a little bit in the early 2000s, whether it was housing wealth or other forms of wealth, and that has really declined and gone away. So just as there was some feeling of some type of stability for many African American middle class and working class families, that's been really taken away. It's something that, it's just a tremendous concern. And also the pattern of this recovery, tends to have been in the coastal cities, where African Americans actually have been going away and moving more to the Midwest and the South, where the recovery hasn't been as strong. And of course, the Midwest, is a large, sector of the African American community. So the parts of the country that are seeing the recovery tend to not be where African Americans are situated, whereas like a New York economy, which has become less African American, has become more immigrant, driven. As it recovers, there's more that baseline service level work that's either not available to African Americans or that workforce isn't here anymore.
Let's close by coming back to some of those big picture solutions that you brought up. Can some of those principles be translated into specific legislation, whether it's repeal of negative free trade regimes or protections for the right to unionize or targeted stimulus programs? What's the kind of legislative agenda that you'd like to see to create a bigger picture fix to this terrible employment situation?
Well, I think immediately we need programs that get people back to work, whether they are temporary publicly subsidized jobs, whether they're subsidizing private employers, whether they're workforce programs that let people work part-time and still get some of their unemployment benefits like they do in Europe with work sharing. Like, that's the immediate agenda. For the people that I care the most about, that we're talking about, people that are unemployed for 2 years, they have an immediate need. They need to get back to work and get something back on their resume, or they're going to be sunk. They're going to be in a competitive situation with other people. And we're, one thing we're seeing is we've started seeing these Craigslist postings that say, unemployed, don't apply, which is, we think is, maybe even illegal, but it speaks to this thing that somehow this is an embedded thing that these are damaged goods and people's skills are deteriorating. They are deteriorating as they're not working. So the most important thing is to get people back to work on a temporary basis. I'd like to see, you know, lots of programs that even if they just get people back to work to 3 to 6 months, you know, would be the, you know, the biggest, you know, priority agenda. And then long term, you know, we see our role and our big mission as you got to strengthen the floor dramatically in terms of minimum wages and living wages and the right to organize. You have to have economic development policies that allow distressed communities to build good jobs and to foster industries and the workforce that can compete in those industries. And then we have to, you know, we have to start keep fighting and breaking down discrimination against the kind of groups that we were just talking about, African Americans, the 75 million Americans that have criminal records. You know, break down the barriers that will, you know, that kind of enforce the polarization that we have in the economy. And although trade isn't our main issue, you know, the idea that we're going to sign a Korean free trade agreement because there are some farmers in Montana, which probably aren't mostly small farmers, they're mostly big agribusiness, that want to sell burgers there, just when we're recovering the big three, which is supporting a huge part of our country in the Midwest that is, you know, just needs to get back on its feet, and we're just going to let, you know, Korean cars kind of come in and kill those jobs. You know, it's just the wrong way of doing it. And it's not how other nations are doing it. It's not how China approaches their economy. That's not how Europe approaches their economy. It's just kind of like folly that we think it's the way that we should approach the economy, because it's better for a certain set of global businesses, but it's not better for the vast majority of people.
Andrew Stettner, Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. You can see their new report, where the jobs are, at their website, nelp.org. Thanks for joining us on Beyond the Pale, Andrew.
You're very welcome.